From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. National Public Radio's senior editor, Ron Elving, is with us today, helping us untangle the major headlines out of D.C. and their impact on New Hampshire politics. For example, President Trump's recent announcement of hefty tariffs on aluminum and steel imports. Here in New Hampshire, most elected officials, regardless of party, criticized the move, saying our state's economy would be hurt, not helped, by higher prices for these materials. We'll talk the politics of trade with Ron Elving. Also, whether Congress will tackle legislation to reduce gun violence or leave it up to the states. And we'll cover the latest twists and turns of the immigration debate. Later in the hour, NHPR's Annie Ropeek will update us on Granite State reaction this week to an offshore oil drilling proposal. And let's hear from you. First on this tariff announcement, what do you think? Are steel and aluminum tariffs a good idea or not? Let us know. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Ron Elving joins us from NPR in Washington. And Ron, welcome to The Exchange. Good to have you.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Laura.
Well, here in New Hampshire, Ron, we've heard lots of opposition to these tariffs from our governor, from many business groups, from our congressional delegation. Who likes these, Ron? Who thinks these are a good idea?
Some people in the White House certainly do. The nationalists, as they're called, seem to have taken over in the long-running struggle within the Trump White House between the nationalists and the globalists, symbolized perhaps by Gary Cohn, who was the chief economic advisor to President Trump and who has responded to this change in the wind by deciding it's time for him to go. So he's leaving the White House largely over this particular issue. So the globalists, of course, have prevailed for decades and generations since World War II in believing that trade is good not only for the world but for the United States. And there has been, all through that period of time, a pushback from people who say, but wait a minute, a lot of our factories can't compete with, say, Mexico, or we can't produce this or that as cheaply as they can in Canada, or we may be seeing a lot of competition from Europe or China, and now that China is such a big player in the world stage, this is largely about China. So this struggle has probably less to do with any one individual issue or any one individual industry or any one particular factory or set of workers than it has to do with a real redefinition of how the world operates, and people who are unhappy with the way it's been operating are getting their opportunity with President Trump to basically fight back.
Well, the president made his argument for tariffs both on economic and national security grounds. So let's hear a little bit of that, Ron. Here's President Trump announcing his steel and aluminum tariffs.
What's been allowed to go on for decades is disgraceful. It's disgraceful. And when it comes to a time when our country can't make aluminum and steel, and somebody said it before, and I will tell you, you almost don't have much of a country. Because without steel and aluminum, your country's not the same. And we need it. We need it even for defense, if you think. I mean, we need it for defense. We need great steel makers, great aluminum makers for defense.
Again, that's President Trump announcing his steel and aluminum tariffs. So, Ron, many people are familiar with the president's position on trade as unfair. He often says that America gets a raw deal from trade agreements like the WTO and so forth. But what about this national defense argument?
This is the reason the president has the power to impose these tariffs unilaterally, because back in the Cold War era, and this particular law is more than 50 years old, back in the Cold War era, there was this sense that we should always have control over the basic materials, the basic raw materials, and also the manufacturing of the actual weapons that we would use in a war. Many people in the 1960s had a vivid memory of how in 1940s we won World War II by outproducing the world. We actually had produced more material in the last year of World War II than Germany had produced in all the war up until then. That's how we buried them in our extraordinary industrial output. We were proud of that, and we were justly proud of it. And people felt as though that was the source of our strength and our preeminence in the world, and we needed to always be sure we could do it all for ourselves. That was how the world operated. The world has operated very differently in more recent decades. And now we are getting used to a world in which you obtain your materials from wherever it makes most sense to obtain them. And that obviously has a lot to do with cost. It also has to do with convenience. And so if you believe that the steel that we get from Canada, for example, could be cut off in some future conflict so that we could no longer make tanks or cannon or guns to defend ourselves, if you believe that that is still some sort of realistic prospect, then you have a national security argument. And at least in this case, that's what the president's putting forward, because that's the justification the law gave him to make these tariffs and put these tariffs in place unilaterally.
Well, as you said a moment ago, the president's top economic advisor, Gary Cohn, resigned over this. And there's been a lot of coverage of that on NPR. But outside the Beltway, Ron, you know, why does that matter? It seems like palace intrigue to us, you know, outside of D.C.
It probably does, and it probably should, in the sense that you're not going to follow every twist and turn in a White House where they've already had 40% turnover in their personnel in 1 year. This is something that I think bores people, and they think, well, these are just, you know, folks who can't get along or high egos who want to go back to Wall Street and make more money, and there's some truth in that for certain. At the same time, when Gary Cohn leaves, not just because he doesn't feel he's being listened to enough, but because he feels he cannot be associated with a beggar thy neighbor policy of going to war with our trading partners, and that includes not just China, who might be the main target here, but also the collateral damage to our relationships with Europe, our relationships with Mexico and Canada, which are obviously in flux with the renegotiation of NAFTA, and with the president saying in just the last few hours, oh, maybe we could have a carve out. Maybe we could say we're going to bar all steel imports, or we're going to charge them 25% extra by just say, well, we're not going to do that for Canada. We're just going to make an exception for them. Well, Canada's our biggest source of foreign steel. So if you do that, do you really have an effective tariff policy that's going to help the domestic industry recover? This is the question that hangs over everything the president is doing right now. Gary Cohn thought this was such terrible policy that he just couldn't be associated with it. So it's not that Gary Cohn is gone. It's why is he gone? And what is he trying to tell us by leaving? And also, in his particular case, what other policies that we aren't talking about yet will also be altered by his absence? He's been seen as a general moderating influence on the president on not only economic issues, but social issues as well.
Well, I want to ask you, Ron, about the reaction in Congress, but also remind our listeners, we'd love to hear from you. We're covering a couple major headlines this morning with Ron Elving, NPR senior editor. Right now, we're talking about the recent tariff announcement from the president. What do you think? Exchange at nhpr.org. Exchange at nhpr.org is our email, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Ron, an email just came in from Brian. He says, thankfully, we finally have a president who will stand behind American workers. And thank you, Brian, for the email, Ron. This is something that Donald Trump really made a point of doing on the campaign trail.
Yes, as much as he talked about the wall with Mexico, he talked about changing our relationships with our trading partners, particularly those in NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, and also with respect to China. Didn't talk so much about some of the other countries that we do business with, but knowing that there was a great deal of resentment about Chinese goods that come to the United States subsidized by the Chinese government, knowing that there were a lot of jobs that had gone away in the last 30, 40 years, that American manufacturing has been in a species of decline. We have lots less of the heavy industry that we used to have. We drive fewer cars that were made in the United States relative to cars made in all the rest of the world, although we're still buying an awful lot of cars that are made in the United States. So the caller certainly has a point that American workers have felt, and with justification, for decades, that their government was working for the world's good, for the global trade agenda, as opposed to protecting American jobs first.
Well, and there is some support in New Hampshire for these tariffs, even though our manufacturing sector tends more towards the high tech end and using imported inputs instead of creating steel and aluminum. But according to a Concord Monitor article by our colleague Paul Steinhauser, there is some political support in New Hampshire for this. Republican State Representative Al Baldessaro, a big, big Trump supporter here in the state, said he disagrees with the governor, agrees with the president on these tariffs. And then Levy Sanders, the newest Democratic candidate in the state's first congressional district, again, quoting from Paul's article here, agreed with the president, saying the tariffs are a very good idea. Levy Sanders saying, you know, for someone who's been in a union for 23 years, I can definitely tell you that folks I talk to overall think it's a good idea. So there's that political oddity, right, Ron, that union members who often vote Democratic actually often like the idea that the president imposes these tariffs.
Yes, and that was one of the reasons, not the only, but that was one of the powerful reasons that a lot of formerly Democratic voting people in labor liked Donald Trump's message. They might not have liked everything about Donald Trump, but they wound up voting for him because they thought he would do these kinds of things, or at least threaten to do these kinds of things, and change the terms of debate, put us in more of an aggressive position in going to the bargaining table with other countries, which we have certainly not usually been since World War II. We may have felt as though we had so many of the cards. The whole world economic system was operating on the dollar, more or less. We were the reserve currency. We were the big dog. And so we felt that we could be generous through a lot of these decades since World War II. And it's come time, many people feel. The AFL-CIO has endorsed President Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum. Many people in the labor movement feel it's time for the United States to stop being magnanimous in its global negotiations and to start to be much more aggressive about the interests of our own companies and our own workers. And that is certainly a legitimate position. It's a powerful position. The question is, what will be the consequences if you really do go about this via tariffs, via the kind of protectionism that the president is talking about? Much as when we get to immigration, we'll talk about what the best way is to balance those concerns.
Right. And we will talk about immigration, also the politics around reducing gun violence. All that's coming up in just a minute with Ron Elving. But we'll take your emails, comments, questions about this tariff proposal for a few more minutes. So send us your comments like Brian did, exchange@nhpr.org. So, Ron, I do want to ask you about the reaction in Congress. And to kick that off, let's hear a little bit from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Here he is speaking to reporters, making it quite clear he does not like this tariff proposal at all.
There is a lot of concern among Republican senators that this could sort of metastasize into a larger trade war. And many of our members are discussing with the administration just how broad, how sweeping this might be. And there's a high level of concern about interfering with what appears to be an economy that's taking off in every respect, as you've heard others suggest here today. So, yeah, there's a high level of concern about it.
All right, that's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Ron, not sounding happy at all.
You know, there is actually a humorous side to what some of our trading partners have done to get the attention of our national Republican congressional leaders. Mitch McConnell comes from Kentucky, and one of the first things we were told by the European Union was that if there were going to be tariffs on steel and aluminum, there were going to be tariffs on U.S. bourbon, which comes from Mitch McConnell's home state, and that they were also going to go after Harley-Davidson motorcycles, which come from Wisconsin, which is the home state of Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House. Cheese, too, while we're at it, which is a real New England story. So this does not happen in a vacuum. And if the United States is actually going to go ahead with this newly aggressive policy on trade, there will be consequences. And the pain of this is always very inequitably distributed. The benefits might go to those people who would keep some jobs in the United States, and U.S. Steel immediately said that they would keep one plant or reopen a plant in Illinois and have 500 jobs saved, so they would have something to hold up and say, here's an example of why Trump is right. And then, of course, we've also heard immediately from people who use a lot of steel and are buying it from cheaper sources, saying, are we going to be able to manufacture the heavy equipment that we've been manufacturing at the price we've been manufacturing it so that we can remain competitive in world markets and sell, for example, huge pieces of construction equipment manufactured in the United States and sold around the world. These are legitimate questions. There will be winners, there will be losers, and one understands that there have been in the past, and some of the people who have been losing feel this is their chance, this is their turn to be the winners. And we will see how all that plays out in the negotiations and in the retaliations that are going to be coming in the weeks and months ahead.
Back to our listeners, Ron, and Andrew is from Keene. Andrew, thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering what your thoughts were about a paper I found online that was positing there was a kind of paradox in that before 1939, a lot of countries that used tariffs had an increase in GDP growth, and post-1939, a lot of countries that imposed tariffs had a major slowdown in GDP growth.
So looking at the idea of earlier on, perhaps, in our history, tariffs worked. But in this more modern era, Andrew seems to be asking, looks like tariffs have been not beneficial.
If you look at 1939 and talk about growth, you're talking about a comparison between the latter part of the Great Worldwide Depression and the earlier part of the Great Worldwide Depression that began around 1929, 1930, 1931. It was bad in the United States. We had 25% unemployment officially, probably was a great deal higher than that. So when the economies of the world began to recover in the late 1930s, unfortunately largely by building the armaments that they would use in World War II, which began in 1939, that is probably true, that countries that had imposed a lot of tariffs at the beginning of the Depression, deepening the Great Depression, we in this country had one called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff, and it deepened the Great Depression. And then in the trough of the Great Depression, you hit the bottom with very little trade. And then towards the end, you get a pre-war and wartime buildup that in all countries probably made their economies look a little healthier, even though it really didn't have that much to do with trade and tariff.
Andrew, thank you for the call. And a Facebook comment from Amanda, who says these tariffs will cause ripples that we will be dealing with for years, harm to our own industries and foreign relations. Amanda says, I think that people are truly focused on the short game. I want to ask you about the maybe longer term game on this politically, Ron. Thank you, Amanda, for the comment, by the way. What happens next on this tariff proposal? Does it go through Congress, or are tariffs really the sole jurisdiction of the executive branch?
In this particular instance, if the president can make an argument of national security significance in steel and aluminum, or of course used in many defense applications, the president has the authority to impose them on his own. It was given to him by Congress. Congress normally would be responsible for this kind of thing. But Congress, as we were talking about earlier, half a century ago, in the midst of the Cold War, said that we can't really ever become dependent on anyone else for the basic raw materials of making a war. So that was steel, that was aluminum, and many other products as well. And the president was given the authority, really, to do this on his own. And that's what we're operating under right now. And Congress is scrambling around. The Republicans, who are the majority in the House and Senate, most of whom are very upset by this policy change, most of whom are more free traders by philosophy. And they're saying, ooh, what can we do to get in the president's way? What can we do to actually keep this from happening? And at the moment, that is a pretty high bar. They would have to pass a new law, and the president would be empowered to veto that new law. And having two-thirds to override the president's veto is probably impossible.
All right. Well, and coming up after a short break, Ron, we will turn our attention to legislation in Congress and in the states aimed at reducing gun violence. We'll talk about that. I also want to share a little bit of an email from Mike. He says, I think what is underplayed here is the importance of having domestic steel and aluminum manufacturing capacity here in the U.S. Mike says it's not just whether or not Canada will continue to provide steel to us during a conflict. It's also a question of who will cover the increased demand for steel during a conflict. So, Mike, thank you for that email. We'll continue taking your questions and comments in just a moment. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Jessica Hunt. I'm a producer for The Exchange. Thank you for listening to the podcast. I'm really excited because I am getting to put together a retrospective about Something Wild. That's another podcast on NHPR. You'll hear it during Morning Edition on Friday mornings. They have been doing that for 20 years, and I am delighted to be able to put together a special episode of The Exchange about Something Wild and their time on the air. But I'm coming to you because I need your help. I need to hear your memories, things that have touched you over the years about Something Wild. Here's the phone number to leave a voicemail, 603-513-7797. Thanks a lot.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, NPR senior editor and Washington correspondent Ron Elving is with us to explore headlines out of D.C. and how they're playing out across the country, including, of course, here in the Granite State. We've covered the president's tariff announcement. We're going to turn now to gun policy and immigration policy. And as always, let's hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Ron, let's turn to gun violence, talk about the political response in Washington and in the states on the goal of reducing the likelihood of yet another mass shooting. It's been 3 weeks since 17 children and adults lost their lives in the latest massacre. You said, Ron, that you've seen these debates play out before after similar mass shootings. The Las Vegas concert, the church in Texas, and on and on. How do these political discussions typically go, Ron? We were talking yesterday that, you know, you've seen more than one of these debates play out.
Sadly, yes. What we start with is it's too soon to talk about this. It's a great tragedy. We should send our thoughts and prayers. And all of those statements, of course, are true. Then that period of time sometimes goes on for some days, and then eventually we start talking about mental health. Certainly this shooter, whoever he was, must have been in some sense or another terribly disturbed. We should talk more about the need for greater mental health programs in general. And of course that is a safe statement. Everyone agrees that we should be able to do more for people who have mental problems. Then we segue into a discussion of whether or not such people should be able to get firearms. And that leads us to a discussion of background checks and whether or not it's possible to ask gun dealers to know everything about someone they're selling a gun. And then we go from that to talking about whether or not certain weapons should simply be banned. We had a 10-year assault weapon or assault-style weapon ban from 1994 to 2004, and then it expired because it had a 10-year sunset provision, and the Republicans who had taken over Congress in the meantime did not want to extend that ban, did not believe in it, and so we have had free sales of AR-15s, as were used in a couple of the shootings that you just mentioned, and other assault-style weapons, which are legally available, although some stores have now said they don't want to sell them anymore, and in many states are legally available to 18-year-olds, including the 18-year-old who did the shooting in Parkland, Florida. So this is the regular progression. When we go through these various stages, people sort of fall away. Everyone's on board for hopes and for thoughts and prayers. Everyone's on board for talking about mental health, but it becomes very difficult to know how to change the system. Everyone's on board for the idea of not selling guns to the wrong people, but not on board for any kind of a system for determining who is the right kind of people or the wrong kind of people. And then finally, we come down to just talking about guns themselves. And at that point, usually some time has passed and some of the initial shock and tragedy has worn off. I hate to say it, but unfortunately we have become inured to these mass shootings. We've become inured even to the shootings in schools. And people will talk about a little bit more of security or maybe asking for this or that. But in the end, if it gets down to talking about actual gun control, actually taking some weapons off the market, support for those ideas dissipates rather quickly. The National Rifle Association is extraordinarily well organized, not just in the sense of money. People put it too much in terms of their campaign contributions. Their real power is in their ability to move votes, which they have proven again and again nationally and at the state level.
So you've seen this progression of this conversation play out pretty much along the same playbook each time around. Does this conversation this time especially given the activism of some of these young people, not only the students affected this time, but high schoolers around the country. Does this time sound different, Ron?
It does in respect to the Parkland shooting, particularly because of those students that you mentioned. Many of them have been not only extraordinarily moving in their testimony, but quite articulate, quite persistent. They organized marches to Tallahassee, Florida, their state capital, and they clearly had an impact there. So at the state level, in Florida, which is a state well known for its liberal gun laws, for its lack of gun control, some people call it the gun shine state, it has actually passed its first serious set of restrictions on purchasing guns that it has had in a generation, more than 20 years. And that is in the face of opposition from the NRA, which is quite powerful in Florida. It has there an extraordinarily effective lobbyist in a woman named Marion Hammer, who is 78 years old and arguably the most effective pro-gun lobbyist at the state level in the nation. She is quite a phenomenon and an institution in Tallahassee. And yet, the Florida State Legislature has passed restrictions on gun ownership, raising the age for buying one of these weapons from 18 to 21, long guns. And Governor Rick Scott, who is certainly an ambitious governor who is thinking about running for the Senate, maybe thinking about running for president someday, has taken that bill home, opened it and said, I'm going to read every word in this and I'm going to decide whether or not I think it's good for Florida. And if I think it is, I'm going to sign it. But most of the things in this bill are things that he has expressed support for in the recent past.
And Ron, you mentioned another area of common ground, even on this difficult issue, is keeping guns out of the hands of people who seem like they are on the verge of committing violent acts. And we do have a background check system, the NICS, as it's called. There's a proposal that I read about from a Texas Republican, Senator John Cornyn, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, would improve federal background checks by incentivizing better reporting to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. What about this, Ron? Is this an area of common ground, strengthening the background check system?
Yes, it is. It is an area where, for example, John Cornyn, the senator you mentioned from Texas, as a Republican, is the number two leader in the Senate, and he's willing to talk about some kind of more effective restrictions on who may buy one of these weapons. He has paired with Chris Murphy from Connecticut, a Democrat, who is a longtime advocate of greater gun control and who was, if you will, radicalized on the issue by the Sandy Hook shootings at that school there several years ago. So this is something that some people in both parties can agree upon. It's a restriction, and perhaps from a strictly political standpoint, not to be crass, but just to be political, the way that you begin to move the borders and the territory of that, talking about guns, is to start with something perhaps small, perhaps peripheral even, and see if you can get some kind of an agreement there. Confront the National Rifle Association and say, we know you don't like this, but this is something we can agree on. And we, even though we are not anti-NRA, anti-gun, we are going to agree on these few small restrictions. That's a small step, and it is not gun control in the sense that we most often think of it, but it is a small step in a direction that the NRA has rejected. And to have a moment of, if you will, pushing back the NRA would be to change the playing field considerably from what we've had in recent years.
What other common ground might exist on this issue of mass violence? I mean, no one, you know, gun control or gun person or pro-gun person, Republican, Democrat, nobody wants children to be killed in school or a loved one to be killed by going to church or the movies. I mean, you know, nobody wants their loved ones to be killed in a massacre. So I just wonder, what other common ground is there on this issue?
Well, of course, the great disagreement comes on how do you prevent those things from happening. And gun advocates say that just taking guns away from law-abiding citizens changes nothing with respect to the non-law-abiding citizens who do these violent crimes, and that those kinds of people would always find some way to find a gun, and they have an argument. I think another thing, though, that people might agree on would be raising the age for purchase of all guns of all kinds. There are some restrictions by age in many states. Extending that to all guns for people to not be able to purchase it until they're 21. Understand that people will say, if you go into the military at 18, you're handling much larger armaments than this. And that is true. But of course, you are doing it in a military context. If you talk about depriving people of the right to buy alcohol until they're 21, it doesn't seem entirely out of the realm of reason to also deny people the right to buy guns. That is something I think people are coming together around, and that might actually happen. Although, again, the NRA totally opposes raising the age limit.
This time, in this latest mass shooting, President Trump initially said he was on board with some gun control ideas, reportedly going so far at one point as to suggest a conversation on an assault weapons ban. Where does that stand now? Where does the president stand now on some of these ideas of reducing, you know, yet another massacre?
We have seen several instances of the president calling in senators and members of Congress from both parties, leaders, people with ideas, and having an on-camera, hour-long discussion sitting there in the White House, and the president being very open to ideas, being particularly encouraging to the Democrats, actually in some cases seeming to scold some of the Republicans who are in the room. Oh, you're just afraid of the NRA, he said to one member of Congress at one of these meetings that I'm describing. And then the very next night, after that on-television performance, the president sat down with Chris Cox, who is the head of the National Rifle Association. Chris Cox emerged from that meeting to say the president is against gun control, the president is fine with the NRA agenda, and everything is as it was before. And the president tweeted out that he supported the NRA fully. So those would seem to be contradictory evenings of the president's schedule at the White House. One night he's one kind of guy, he's acting in a particular way and seeming very open to certain ideas, and the next night seeming to say no, not at all. So we will have to wait to see where the president comes down. If there is actually legislation at some point or another put on his desk, would he sign it or not? The Rick Scott decision that he's making down in Florida, the governor there. That could happen. The other way that we might see more of the president's actual feelings on guns would be what he would be willing to support in terms of proposals in the Congress. But here again, we are already passing into that phase of a post-tragedy discussion about guns in which delay has done its work, and we are moving on to talking about tariffs and talking again about immigration and talking about various and sundry palace intrigue and scandals in the White House, and less talk about guns every day.
Well, I do want to ask you about immigration, but two more questions for you, please, Ron, about this gun control debate and the politics of it. An email came in from Mike who says there's an argument that's being made on conservative radio that Democrats did not pass gun control during the Obama administration when they controlled Congress. What's the truth of this? Mike, thanks for the email. And Ron, first of all, just a point of fact, Democrats controlled Congress during the Obama administration. That was 08 and 09, right? So they controlled it for 2 years. And then it switched over to Republicans in 2010. Am I correct?
That is absolutely correct. Also, the Democrats, when they very briefly had the votes to prevail in the Senate, just really a matter of a few months, focused on passing health care. That's when Obamacare got through the Senate. They had certainly control in the House for those same 2 years, and they probably could have passed some kind of a gun control bill at that time in the House. Whether they could have done it in the Senate is a much, much tougher call. You would have to assume absolute lockstep, every Democrat on board for it, in the very brief period of time that they had 60 votes. Thereafter, they did not and did not have it for very long. They might have prioritized guns over health care, but at the time, that was not where the political energy was running by any means. And they also, I'm sure, had the sense that at every time in the past when they had prioritized gun control as an issue, it had come back to bite them rather hard in the next election. We saw that after the assault weapons ban was passed in 1994, the Democrats lost control of House and Senate that very fall. that very November, right after that assault weapons ban was passed. We saw it in the Al Gore election in 2000. If the Democrats are associated in some states with gun control, it seems to cost them at the polls, or at least it did in those eras. Now, some time has passed since both of those elections I mentioned, and the Democrats may be, in some sense, learning the last lesson and not looking forward. And maybe that's why they didn't prioritize it in those 2 years right after Obama was elected in 2008.
Okay, Mike, I appreciate the point. Thanks for the email. One last question for you on this, Ron, please. There's a march planned in Washington talking about, you know, shifting political winds on this issue. There's a big march planned in D.C. later this month called March for Our Lives. There are sister marches planned in a lot of other cities around the country. What's your sense, Ron, of what impact this might have, especially if a lot of people show up?
A few moments ago, I said that people are not talking about guns so much today as they were a few weeks ago, and that it seems to dissipate a little every day. One of the ideas behind this march is to reverse that energy and to get people back on the page, back on the issue of gun control, and say, yeah, it's fine to talk about NICS, it's fine to talk about better background checks, it's fine to talk about raising the age limit, but what we want is something that would really make a difference in terms of taking some of these guns out of the hands of some of these people. And one way to do that would be to go back to the assault-style weapons ban. That is going to be the theme of this march, as I understand it, 2 weeks from Saturday. And these people are going to change the conversation for a period of days. They're going to have everyone focused on guns again, one assumes. And it takes that kind of political activity to make a difference. But ultimately, that is not enough. What has to happen, if gun laws are going to change, is that different people need to be elected to make different laws. And that doesn't happen just with marching. It happens with elections.
I want to talk briefly with you, Ron, about immigration reform. This has come up a lot in Washington recently with the president's announcement last fall that he would get rid of DACA, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals, unless broader reform was done. And since then, boy, we've been heard so much about this, a series of deadlines, one on March 5th, wants to be later to be said later this month. We will have reform. No, we won't. We are going to get together on this. No, we aren't. Mitch McConnell promises he will. Then we don't hear anything. Help us figure this out, Ron. First of all, this series of deadlines. What are these all about?
The president, when the president was Barack Obama, used an executive action to defer action on childhood arrivals. Deferred action on childhood arrivals is where DACA comes from, D-A-C-A.
Right.
And then when President Trump came in, having opposed that, he said, I don't see any reason that we should keep that unless we can make it part of some much larger look at all the aspects of the immigration system that I would like to change in the direction that I would like to change them. I want to get rid of what President Trump calls chain migration, which has in the past officially been called family reunification. He wanted to have a wall, of course, famously on the Mexican border. And this would be the price for making permanent the deferred action status for these childhood arrivals, people who came to the country when they were minors, brought by their parents in most cases, and really something they had no control over. Many of them have lived here their entire life, with the exception of a few years, and know no other country. So this is a special category within people who are in this country illegally, within the people who are in this country without documents. So the president said, look, you all want to do something for these folks, and I'd like to do something for them, too. I have nothing but love in my heart for the Dreamers, he said at one point. And the Dreamers is the term that President Obama had given to these childhood arrivals. They were Dreamers in the sense that they wanted to be part of the American dream. So President Trump says, those folks are going to have to leave now, and set a March 5th deadline. Of course, people went to court to question whether or not the president could do that. By and large, the courts have said, yes, eventually the president could do that. But right now, this March 5th deadline looks kind of arbitrary, and we need to see more information about this, that, and the other thing. So the courts have held up the enforcement of the March 5th repeal, if you will, of the deferred action. That means that these people are still staying here in limbo. It means 700,000 or 800,000 people who have identified themselves to the federal government might yet at some point be rounded up and deported. It means another 1 million people who are in the same status but haven't identified themselves to the federal government could be apprehended and deported. So we're looking at eventually having a cliff here, but the courts have pushed that cliff off a little bit.
Well, Ron, thank you so much for helping us out. We really appreciate it. It's always fun to talk to you.
Always a pleasure, Laura.
That's Ron Elving, NPR senior editor, correspondent for the Washington Desk. Coming up, offshore oil drilling off the coast of New England. Annie Ropeek will fill us in. Stay with us.
Everyone could do with a bit of Irish luck now and again, which is why you should support NHPR today. When you do, you'll get not one, but two chances to win a trip to Dublin, Ireland, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. That's two chances to see the brilliant Cliffs of Moher, stroll through St. Stephen's Green, or drink in some knowledge at the Old Jameson Distillery. The lucky winner will be picked on St. Paddy's Day, but you can increase your odds now with your gift today at nhbr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We turn now to another story of huge interest in coastal New England, offshore oil drilling. In January, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke proposed an expansion of drilling on most of the U.S. coast, including protected areas of the Atlantic. Since then, coastal states nationwide have expressed opposition, and the Department of the Interior website has received more than a million comments from a wide variety of people, most of them taking issue with the plan. And some of them turned out at a Monday public forum in New Hampshire, held by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. NHPR environment and energy reporter Annie Ropeek was there, and she joins us now. And Annie, thank you very much.
Hi.
Well, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. First of all, what is the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management?
Yeah, so we call it BOEM. It is the part of the Department of the Interior that is in charge of oil and gas drilling. It used to be like the Minerals Service. I can't remember the exact name, but they used to be in charge of mining and that kind of thing. And now it's this separate little thing that came up after the Deepwater Horizon spill on the Gulf Coast.
So relatively new agency.
Yeah, it's a sort of a new form of the drilling part of the federal government that kind of oversees safety and regulations and where drilling goes on the outer continental shelf, which is sort of the far offshore boundaries of the country.
So Pacific and Atlantic,
yes.
Not just the Atlantic, although, mm-hmm. Of course, for the purposes of our discussion, we'll focus on the Atlantic. So BOEM came to New Hampshire this week. What happened?
They did, yeah. So they've been going around to every state that's included in this new plan, which covers 90-some percent of the nation's coastlines, including Alaska, the Gulf Coast, the whole Pacific and Atlantic coasts. So it's parts of the country that haven't been really under consideration for real drilling activity in years. And so they have been answering questions for residents and stakeholders, just kind of trying to provide information so people can make more educated comments. That basically seems like that's their mission. They haven't been taking verbal testimony, so this was not a hearing or a listening session. More of almost a science fair kind of feeling, with trifold boards and just people getting to ask questions of government employees.
Well, the Department of the Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, again, you mentioned that this covers a lot of land along the coast, Annie. And Ryan Zinke said this is important to at least look at because so much, he said, of our shorelines right now are not open to drilling. This audio is from NPR, by the way.
When I came in the office, we looked at what was available for oil and gas and what wasn't. And today, about 94% of our outer continental shelf is off limits for possible development.
So that's Ryan Zinke, Annie, kind of making the case that, look, a lot of this is off limits and maybe it should be on limits.
Yeah, so it was interesting to read through the proposal when it first came out. They have maps that show kind of the economically viable oil and gas. So that basically means what is in the ocean floor that it would be kind of worth it to try to get to. That it would be worth more selling it than it would take to access it. And so they say that the North Atlantic section, which is basically the Gulf of Maine, contains about 3% of the nation's economically viable oil and gas resources. That's potential. So just 3%. I mean, the hot spots are really still the Gulf and Alaska's North Slope and a few other spots. But, you know, we're pretty far down on the list. We also don't have any of the infrastructure set up for this. I mean, places like California and Washington State don't either that are part of this proposal. You know, the oil and gas industry in the country is really concentrated in the Gulf and in Alaska, and that's where they're sort of prepared to do this kind of stuff. This would be a huge uphill kind of change for a region like ours if it were to happen.
A lot of infrastructure would have to be put into place. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us with your comments and questions about this offshore drilling proposal that Annie's been covering. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800 800-892-6477. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter, too, if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. We're talking about this recent proposal to expand, or at least explore expansion, of offshore oil drilling off of the Atlantic coast, especially here in New England. So, boom. Again, Annie, this agency comes to town. They have this forum. Who turns up?
Yeah, so there was a protest outside, first of all. They kind of came early and then all sort of filtered inside once they finished holding their signs and wanted to actually kind of get some information. And so there were a lot of the protesters inside, but also just people who had reasonable, serious questions. You know, I mean, there was some sort of oppositional feeling from some people to the government employees, I would say, but also just plenty of people who had earnest questions and were ready to sit down when they were done talking to the folks and write an earnest comment about what they thought about the plan. So, like I said, kind of a science fair atmosphere. They had all these posters set up with maps and data and, you know, the different ways that they do their offshore drilling exploration. Government employees stationed at each of those little stations, and people just got to go around and ask questions and then sit and write their comment at the end.
So it wasn't, Annie, like a regular public forum where the government official is at the front of the room, he or she makes, you know, a statement or a justification and then says, I'm open to questions for the audience. Everybody has 2 minutes or something like that. It wasn't a moderated open forum like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, not at all. And there's been some criticism of that. The Sierra Club and some other environmental groups held their own, what they called an unofficial public hearing to allow verbal oral testimony to let people use their voices, you know, and then they're collecting those statements and they're going to submit those as comments. But, you know, Boehm says that it's really looking for almost practical feedback here. I talked to Renee Orr. She's in charge of strategic resources at Boehm. So that's the whole office that's basically spearheading this plan. She's been with the department since the 1980s, interestingly. This is the first time she and a lot of other career folks have even had to think about the North Atlantic. And she says, you know, sessions like this are really designed to give people an opportunity to make an effective criticism of the proposal rather than just telling the secretary it's good or it's bad.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Renee Orr.
I hate oil and gas, or I love oil and gas. That's really not informative to the decisions that he has to make and the balancing that he has to do.
So go ahead. So, he being Ryan Zinke.
So she wants people to write comments that the secretary can actually use to reshape his proposal in some practical way. I mean, I think she understands there is a lot of strong feelings about this that are pretty broad ideological feelings. And they respect those, but I think there's some question as to how useful those are to Secretary Zinke, whose idea this was, you know, and if people really want to see places like the North Atlantic taken out of consideration, which is entirely possible. So this is just a draft of the draft, right? So we're public comment on this one closes tomorrow, and then
coming up,
he will revise the plan based on the comments he gets now and put out sort of a final proposal at the end of the year. And there will be another public comment session on that. So this time around, they're really looking for stakeholders in the regions to be giving sort of localized feedback to say, you know, I live in Portsmouth and this is exactly what this would do to my personal business and my life and why I don't think you should do it or why I think you should.
Let's hear from our listeners, Annie. Again, you can send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Annie, Al's calling us from Concord. Hi, Al. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Well, thank you. My question was, I believe that Secretary Zinke has exempted Florida from the drilling where Mar-a-Lago is. Am I correct in that?
I don't think that it's just Mar-a-Lago, but I know that Governor Rick Scott of Florida was concerned about this, and I, to my knowledge, they've told Florida the same basic thing they've told New Hampshire, which is, we hear you, we will consider taking you out of the running. So,
well, yeah, what's that process like? Because I think Governor Sununu has also said he doesn't like this. So what's the process by which governors along the Atlantic coast say, you know,
Yeah, so I know that Governor Sununu got to go down to D.C. and had a private meeting with Secretary Ryan Zinke and laid out his concerns about this plan. You know, he has been clear from the beginning. He does not want to see drilling in New Hampshire. He says, you know, based on our size would be devastated by any kind of spill or anything like that. It's interesting. We're such a small part of the coastline that we almost get, you know, more of the harm than we do the benefit just because of how small of a piece we are. It's like, it would cover the whole coastline, and we are making up less of sort of the economic foundation of drilling in New England. So Sununu seems encouraged that Secretary Zinke heard him and will consider taking at least New Hampshire, if not New England, out of the running. And I believe that they've had similar conversations with Governor Scott around Florida.
Well, thank you for that call, Al. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You know, Annie, you mentioned that this agency, BOEM, again, the Bureau of Ocean, Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, wants to hear from stakeholders. Now, given what you said about New England, that we don't really have an oil and gas, you know, offshore drilling industry here, it seems like most of the quote-unquote stakeholders would be people who wouldn't like this, you know, oceanside tourism, fishermen, people like that.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, there's not really an established drilling industry here to advocate
right.
for this. And so, you know, the theoretical benefits of this would be construction kind of jobs and infrastructure logistics jobs to set it up and to run the processes, to drive the stuff around, to run the coastal, you know, the port side kind of stuff. And, you know, we do have a shipping and logistics industry here already, certainly in Maine and Massachusetts and Rhode Island. And there is also offshore energy development in places like Rhode Island. But that's very different when you're talking about wind turbines than it is an oil well. And so I think most of the voices in this conversation in this part of the country are environmentalists, people from the tourism industry, fishermen, certainly.
Lobstermen in Maine.
Yeah, absolutely. And even our recreational fishermen in New Hampshire, you know, a nearshore spill could get washed in very quickly on our currents and devastate the charter boat kind of fisheries that really drive parts of the economy on the seacoast.
What are the benefits that the Trump administration thinks this could bring to, you know, not just the country, but let's be parochial to the region?
Yeah, so they're trying to frame this basically as the resources that are down there, the potential oil and gas that's in the ocean, belongs to all Americans. That's the language we heard a lot at this forum in Concord. And so that basically there is untapped money to be made out there and fuel for us to use to depend on our own energy instead of importing a lot of it, or to export to other countries to sell and make money for the country and make tax revenues and jobs for the regions that would support that drilling industry. You know, again, New England, that's a really uphill hill to climb. And also places like California and Washington, even Florida, you know, there's just not a lot of infrastructure out there for this already. It's been very regionalized. And so so this would be a big change for a lot of the places that it comes to. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see what the final proposal is. It may be more of a, we're going to keep places open for exploration, but we'll push off the leasing for these places that are really concerned about it. But we'll really ramp up the leasing and the actual drilling in the places where it's already happening. I think that would be sort of a practical course to take, but it's anyone's guess what the secretary will come up with.
So the Trump administration is basically saying, look, New England, you know, we're all Americans, we're all in this together, and other places have drilling, so you can look at it too.
Yeah, that it's down there, and just because you're not getting it out right now doesn't mean you couldn't try. There's been exploration for oil and gas in New England at one point in the past. I believe it was in the 1980s or 90s. And those are the surveys that they're sort of basing this off of.
Well, here's an email from Josh who just came in. Josh says he's a Portsmouth City councilor. He says, the additional carbon released from opening up the Gulf of Maine to offshore drilling may negate the renewable energy policy that the Portsmouth City Council passed Monday night. And any spill could be a disaster for our local economy. Thanks, Josh, for the email. And I'm wondering how strongly the tourism industry was out in force, Annie, at this BOEM meeting.
Yeah, Josh is talking there about Portsmouth's new all renewable energy goal that they're working toward. And he's right that this is a climate change issue in part, but it is also a practical issue of what will happen to our beaches and to our sort of inland waters. I mean, things that could get swept into the Piscataqua or
the Great Bay.
And so, so you heard from a lot of people who came in from the seacoast who are really worried about the beach, you know, or who had a second home there, or spent lots of time there from other parts of the state, who could just foresee, you know, even a small spill or the aesthetic effect of new infrastructure having a huge economic effect on places like Portsmouth and Rye and parts of the seacoast that really rely on that this stuff, especially in the summertime.
And some of the comments I read, Hampton Beach especially very concerned, maybe even some of the elected officials in New Hampshire said, look, we invested a lot of money in that Hampton Beach State Park. It's a huge moneymaker for the state. Let's not put it at risk.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we saw Governor Sununu come out against this just immediately. I mean, he is definitely no enemy to the Trump administration necessarily. And so and he's certainly not an enemy of fossil fuels necessarily. And so he has been clearly against this from the start. I think he's really clearly prioritizing tourism as an economic foundation over any potential that this could bring.
So the next step, Annie, in terms of what this agency plans to do, the feeling that I got from hearing your report was that Renee Orr, who we heard from earlier, was saying, look, don't panic. Nobody freak out. This is just a draft of a draft of a draft of a draft. Like, nothing is set in stone yet. So what's the next step?
Yeah, so like I said, the comment period for this draft of a draft closes tomorrow. So if you have last-minute thoughts you want to get in, you can go onto BOEM's website and find out how to submit those. And then Secretary Zinke and his staff will go through all of those. Did you say more than a million comments have been submitted? Yeah, so they're going to go through all that stuff. They're going to talk to all the governors and the senators and the politicians who have been speaking out against this. And they're going to come up with a final version of what areas they would actually like to open to new leasing and when. And they'll do that by the end of the year, so in December. And then there would be a 90-day comment period on that. That's sort of the official, like, it would go on the Federal Register, and that's the formal rulemaking process. And then after that, they would come out with a final version. Those would include formal public hearings and that kind of thing.
So they're following the usual process for these types of proposals, Annie. But how much do these comments count?
That's a great question. I think it's hard to say. It was interesting to hear some of the people talking to the BOEM employees at the forum in Concord. You know, there was everything from really detailed scientific questions, you know, people pointing to the map and the federal employee pointing to the map and saying, what does this mean? And what if this happened? And trying to understand, you know, what about a gas surplus or what if there's a shortage and what does that mean for where you would drill and the prices and the really detailed questions of how the drilling industry works. And then on the other side of the room, you know, we had I stood and listened for a while to one woman talking to a federal employee about climate change and how this fits into that. So it's hard to say what kind of comments they're really interested in and what taking a comment into account even means. But I think they've certainly heard plenty of them, and it'll be just an interesting process to see what those come up with.
Annie, thank you so much for helping us out. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
NHPR Energy and Environment reporter Annie Ropeek. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. By the way, we're on Instagram at NHPR Exchange, so check it out for some fun behind-the-scenes photos. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.